Let's get started. I'm going to teach on creation and all the implications of creation and creationism. Compare it to what the options are. Compare it to what it used to be. What creation used to, people used to think about creation, and how it's changed over the years, and how belief in the Bible is what actually created science. What we know of is science. And that the people who created the discipline of science, the scientific method and all that, these were all devout Protestant Christians. There were a few Catholics involved, but even the Catholics involved were Reformation Catholics. These were Catholics that opposed the status quo in the Catholic Church. People like Blaise Pascal, who was a Jansenist Catholic, which means he was a Catholic who would believe like Protestants, but still was a member of the Catholic Church. It's, you know, Calvinistic Catholics and people like that. But almost all of the founders of modern science were Christians. There's a book, and I'm going to recommend it. It's by Henry Morris. I got this one at a half price for $1.50, or somewhere else for $1.50. Anyway, Henry Morris calls Men of Science and Men of God, gives about 60 different founding scientists or people, very important scientists, people like Robert Boyle, one of the founders of the Royal Society, or Francis Bacon, or even Leonardo da Vinci, and these are all believers in the Bible, and Isaac Newton, and Michael Faraday, and Louis Pasteur, all of them opponents of modern scientific atheism, and how much science has betrayed its beginnings, and now it's become a declaration of naturalism, where they do not believe in supernatural anything, not even creation, especially not creation. Anyway, let's go to Genesis chapter 1 just to get a fix on what we're going to deal with. It's really not a big stretch for us to say that the Bible teaches creationism. The Bible teaches the creation of the world by God. It's mentioned, I'm guessing hundreds, I didn't count them, but it's mentioned probably hundreds of times in the Bible that God created the heaven and the earth, and starts off in the very beginning, says, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth, in case you don't know where I'm at, I'm in Genesis 1:1. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. So on the first day, we have the creation of, I believe I've narrowed it down so that you can see that at least by the first day, we had to have the creation of at least five important things. The first one is time in the beginning. The second one is space, created the heaven. Third is matter, created the earth. Then it says, let there be light, created light or electromagnetism or that kind of energy or the forces of energy, including heat and other things that are considered part of it. And then, of course, he says he divided the light from the darkness, which is one of the most important ones, and that is that he created laws that govern how these things interact, how matter interacts with space, and how, and of course, in Einstein's theory, it all is connected. It's all joined together in some way, but at the same time, it's all divided. Well, there's a difference between the strong nuclear force and the weak nuclear force. There's a difference between gravity and electromagnetism. And yet they say they're all connected together. And time is connected to matter and distance and size and time passed and all this stuff and speed. All this stuff is relative. It all is hooked together, and they've done experiments to try to prove it. I'm not deep enough in that kind of science to know whether they have proved it or not. But most scientists that are deep into that, even Christian scientists, do not deny it. So I don't have a reason to deny it either. But here's the point. What we have in the very beginning is the description of God creating everything that we see, the universe, or at least the solar system. He's creating it all in this text that we have, that he says, I'm creating all this, And he creates it at the very beginning, showing how all of these things had to have been created from the start. And all understanding of what creation consists of understands that those are the five things that have to be created. Those things, if you're going to have a creation, those are the things that you have to have created. Now compare that to any other creation myth, what they call the creation myths, the Babylonian or the Akkadian and the Chaldean and the Sumerian and the ancient Chinese ones and the ancient Aztec ones. All these creation myths, they're not even close to giving any kind of a scientific concept of what creation entails. If you're going to have a creation of the universe as we understand it now, what it is, you know, that big balls of gas out there and galaxies and gravity and electromagnetism and light shooting out everywhere and going a certain speed and matter having mass, which causes gravity and the forces of angular momentum and ellipses and the ratios, you know, of twice the distance, half the gravity, all these ratios and all these things combined, we know that we had to have time, because time is an entity. Time is something. It's not just automatic that it exists always forever. That's the steady state idea that eternity has always existed. Time has always existed. And no, that's not true. We know that time had to have a beginning. Time, because time is connected to matter, and time is connected to energy. Time is connected to everything. It's connected to distance. It's connected to space. Even the modern science fictionists all will talk about the time-space continuum, meaning that it's together. If you stretch one, you shrink the other one. It's like the big rubber band. Everything's connected. So you had to have a actual creation of all of these things, and lo and behold, in the first few verses of the Bible, all of them are mentioned as having been created. It's as if whoever wrote the first chapter of Genesis knew what creation had to entail, or how could it be included at all? How could he get all of it together that we know all has to be there? So the fact is, we're dealing with the revelation here in Genesis 1. We're dealing with a revelation of something that's beyond our own wisdom without it. In other words, you're not going to get someone who just goes out, and you guys could do this as sort of a homework. You could go out and just think what you can see. Look at the sun, look at the moon, look at the stars, look at the mountains, look at the oceans, look at how things work. Without knowing any of the sciences, don't think about what you learned in school or whatever, and just think, how would you figure out all this stuff? You see lights in the heaven, they're stars, we know they're stars, but say you don't know they're just the same as our sun. Say you don't know that they're like planets. Say you don't know what these are. Say you don't know what the moon is, and you don't know what the sun is. What would you come up with? And basically, you'd come up with a whole bunch of the junk that people did come up with. And this mysterious idea that it's all some kind of a God realm, a spiritual realm out there, whereas people began to be superstitious about these things. And they started noticing things happening in the sky that they couldn't explain, and all of that stuff, and it all gets swept away by something written in the Bible. And I personally think this part was written in the Bible very, very early. I don't think Moses wrote it originally. I'm assuming it was written by Adam, but maybe it was written by Seth, you know, or I don't know. It was written very early because it contains information that, you know, you can't calculate, you can't figure out. So it was either revealed by God to Adam or to someone, or maybe it was revealed to Moses, I guess. But there's so much else that had to have been written down as records in the book of Genesis, that wasn't just given by God as revelation, because you can see it says in the book of Adam or in the book, in such and such a book, or before there was a king. It's obviously they're taking records that existed, or Moses took records that existed and compiled them together in a book called Genesis. It's entirely possible that he put together this book called Genesis while he was still in Egypt. While he had all the records of Egypt, he had all the power. He had wealth. He was part of the royal seed. I mean, he wasn't really part of the royal seed. He was one of the daughters of Pharaoh. The son of one of the daughters of Pharaoh. And if you know how things worked back in those days, Pharaoh would have had probably 1,000 daughters, you know, or 100 daughters at least. So, and a daughter isn't an heir. She's going to be married off to someone. So it's not like she was a really important, like, not like the Ten Commandments movie, you know, where Moses is next in line to the throne. That's not reality. He was in the royal family, which means he was of a noble class, which means he got an education, which means he had options as far as his career. He could be in the military. He could be in the teaching class. He could be in the priest class. He had those open doors, but he wasn't in the royal line. But one way or the other, he had tremendous ability to be educated, and he had people at his beck and call that could do the research. And so he might have put all this book of Genesis together by doing original research and finding the original writings of these things. And so what we see here is a record of something that descended, as far as I can tell, from the very beginning. Now, this is the point. Since the idea of evolution, the modern idea of evolution is an ancient idea called, it was some kind of a creation idea way back by the Greeks, back before Christ. But in the modern idea of evolution, which started coming to fore in the 1700s, maybe the late 1600s, something like that, where they come up with the idea of evolution, that everything has just formed gradually and according to certain processes. And they started believing in the idea of evolution. They started expecting that even religion evolved and people evolved and species evolved, and all of this thing starts happening. They didn't understand the principles of how it could have happened, but they had the philosophy that it all just evolved a little at a time. And they came up with the idea that our religion, the Bible religion, just evolved as a monotheistic religion. It was a higher evolved type of religion than say multi-gods, polytheism, and from animist religions like you find in the jungles, where they think every, like the Indian, American Indians believed everything had a spirit. It's called animist religions, where the rocks have a spirit and the birds have a spirit and you have a spirit and everything has a spirit. And that's the animist religions, or the Hindu and all these others that have polytheism. And they thought that monotheism was the ultimate, highest, evolved type of religion. And so they assumed that it all built up. So polytheism builds up into monotheism over the years by observations and what have you. And basically that's a way of thinking we're smarter than everybody else. That's all these Europeans were thinking. We're smarter than everybody else because we've got this higher evolved religion. And the truth is, monotheism, one God hypothesis, was around, that was the original belief. That's what the Melchizedekians believed. This religious, there's a book on it about what they called the Jehovah cult, that you can find in Genesis and in all the records of the peoples that lived before. It's the God of heaven. Don Richardson writes a book about it, Eternity in Their Hearts. And it's about all of these original, early primitive religions. They're all monotheistic. Even the Indians here in the United States had the primitive belief in a one God created everything thing. This God was called and all the Indians, they had a belief in him. I've lost his name somehow. I haven't taken my Prevagen. So anyway, he had this one God that he was above all the other gods. All the other gods were below him. And so what we see, it is not an evolution of religion, but it started off at the beginning. In the beginning, they all knew there was one God that created everything. You don't find records of polytheism before the flood. They didn't say God was angry at them for being idolaters. They all knew that there was one God. And you don't find polytheism for a while after the flood. It took a while. And the deviation from those beliefs. Now, you get down into the 600 years before Christ era, or, you know, 1,000 years before Christ, and you start seeing a bunch of local deities, local gods. And they had these nonsense myths about these local gods that, you know, that created this river or created that thing. But that doesn't deny that they all had a belief in this super God that created all things. And it's really a natural expectation. Even the Greeks with their polytheism, they accepted every God and they just incorporated it into their pantheistic religion where everything, you know, has a God to it. And the Romans followed the Greeks. And so you had them, even them, their gods that they had, Zeus and all these things, they weren't the original creator God. They were sub-gods. They were the peon gods that were barely any better than humans. The only difference is they couldn't die. That's what these gods were. They were immortal. But anyway, they lost all the concept of this original creation, and they lost the concept of what creation actually was. But think about it in the beginning when you have all of these people thinking about God, and they know that God created all these things, because I believe this part of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, was written early on and they all had access to it. They all had at least some kind of access that it was repeated orally. Some people would think it was repeated orally and was only written down later on, way later on. But it's very possible that it was written early on, because Genesis 5:1 says the book of the generations of Adam was written down. So the book of the generations of Adam, from Genesis 5 on, and you'll find the generations of Noah, the generations of Joseph, the generations of Jacob. It's all the way through the book of Genesis. So that it looks like this is a compilation of a bunch of books. But what I'm saying here is that this record of a creation was from the beginning, and people had to degenerate from that. They had to devolve. They fell away from knowledge that they used to have. They used to know that God, the God that created everything, was separate from everything, and that the sun was also a creation, not a God. They knew that the moon was a creation. All the way through the Bible, the sun is a created thing of God. The moon is a created thing by God. The stars were placed in their place by God. Even the book of Job, which is probably the oldest full document that we have in the Bible, probably predating Abraham, and there's a lot of reasons to believe that. I'm not going to go into them right now. Someday I'll do a survey on the book of Job, but the idea is this ancient book that doesn't mention the law of Moses ever and mentions the flood many, many times, that they just came over the flood, and talks about their ancestors on the other side of the flood. It's interesting how the book of Job deals with that. But you find them talking about, you know, the God hanging the earth upon nothing. This is primitive, primitive theology, and they already know God's hanging the earth upon nothing. And then, of course, you have Isaiah, 700 years before Christ, saying the earth is a circle. They knew these scientific things that other cultures had lost. And the people who hung on to the Bible kept the primitive understanding of how things were. From the beginning, they knew God had created everything. This is not a newfangled idea. It's not a developed idea. It was the original, primitive idea that people had. And all of these other religions had fallen away from that knowledge. But when you look at something like the book of Genesis, that comes like basically giving you a description of the creation, how it all began, then you have to realize this is like a description of something that had just happened and that they could tell. And actually, if you look out at it now, especially with our scientific knowledge that we learn in primary school, I mean, you know that the earth revolves around the sun, and we know that the moon revolves around the earth, and we know the principles of gravity and these things. And this is, before you even get into middle school, you got a basic understanding of the heavens, of our solar system and the planets and these things. They got them all named. I knew from the time I was in elementary school, I knew that there was 9 planets, and now they tell me there's not. There's only 8. But anyway, I don't know. I don't know how they want to call it or what have you. I'm not complaining about their science. I'm just saying what we know about the existence of everything fits exactly what Genesis chapter 1 says. It fits. They have not disproved the Bible by any astronomical discovery or by any physical discovery or any chemical discovery. They have not disproved the Bible. Now, they might claim that the Bible is strange in some of the things it says, and I'm going to give you a few things here in the first chapter of Genesis that, you know, might give some people pause. They're a little bit strange, but that's not a disproof because they haven't proved them wrong. For example, I'll give you one. He calls the heaven the firmament. That's a strange. From the day I first heard that, I thought, well, that's strange. Why do they call it a firmament? And it's a poetic now. It's the poetic rendering of the heaven, all the way in literature, in songs, in poetry, all the way in English. It's the firmament. It's not the firmament in Spanish. It's not the firmament in, it might be the firmament in Latin. I don't know. I haven't checked that out. But whatever it is, they got this idea of a firmament. In Hebrew, it's a funny word. It's a word that they used when they would beat metal in to stretch it. What they call malleable metals, a thicker copper or iron, and they beat it, and when they beat it, it stretches. Have you seen those copper big tubs in Mexico? These huge tubs are expensive, but they're copper tubs, and they're beat with a hammer. They take a hammer and they put it on a big old anvil, and they beat this copper, and this copper just keeps on spreading out, and they beat it and they form it around, and it's a huge tub that they use to make carnitas, a big old copper tub that they use to make carnitas. Well, the word for beating it out is the same word that's translated firmament. And so what the word actually means is to expand. So it's called an expanse. The firmament is a heaven, and it's called an expanse, meaning a stretching out, meaning that the heavens were stretched out. And throughout the Bible, it talks about the heavens being stretched out. He stretched out the heavens with the span of his hand. That's what he says over there in Isaiah or something like that. It's throughout the Bible. It talks about the heavens being stretched out. And, you know, in the 1920s or the 1910s or something like that, they discovered that the heavens were stretching out. That they're still stretching out. And it's very counterintuitive, like very good scientists, nearly all the scientists of the day said, that can't be, it's not true. They had this steady state theory. They thought, you know, that the heavens are always the same. Eternity is eternal. It doesn't change. Time doesn't change. It's always going to be like this. Planets form, suns form, they die, other ones form. It just always stays the same because it's eternal. And Edwin Hubble, others had theorized it, but Edwin Hubble proved it by the displacement of the spectrum of light, and that certain stars had a much stronger displacement of the spectrum, the Doppler effect, which means they must be going faster, and those stars are the ones we can tell are farther away. And, well, that's very interesting. And the conclusion that all the scientists came to, and I'm not sure if it's even true, but the conclusion that they all came to was that the heavens are stretching out. At least they were back when the light left them. What they say, the light takes billions of years to get here, and I don't know that's true either. But they say it gets take that long to get here. So whenever that light left, the heavens were stretching. So the heavens have been stretched. Now whether they're still stretching out there, how can we know? We got to wait a few billion years for all that light to get here, and so then we can tell whether they've stopped stretching or not. What they've done is they've done other computer model experiments to find out what they know about the universe now that it's stretching out. They wanted to know whether it's flat or whether it's, you know, it's going to stretch out forever and never bounce back, or whether it's going to get to a point and stop and come back together. You know, this is their idea. And you know what they found out? They found out not only is the universe expanding, but it's expanding at an accelerating rate. The expansion is getting greater. So they think there's some mysterious force that's forcing it apart. Now, I have no explanation for any of that. I just know that if you read the Bible and it says the firmament, which means an expansion, you got to stop. And how many times the Bible says God stretched the heavens? You got to stop and think, you know, if I'd have just paid attention to the Bible from the start, I'd have been leap years ahead. I don't know what I'm saying. I'd be way ahead of the scientists, because that's exactly what's happened. The heavens were stretched out. Now, going back to Genesis chapter 1, I want you to notice several things. Besides the existence in the very first day of a creation of the very basic elements of creation, including time, space, matter, light or energy, heat, and all that, and laws that divide things and make them act a certain way, all of that's necessary. And I want you to consider this: how could any of that stuff just happen? That is just impossible. That stuff doesn't just happen. The existence, just to think, okay, how does time come into being? I mean, let's say there's nothing. And I mean really nothing. How does time come into being?
Yeah.
It's just a stupid thought. You can't create yourself. I mean, this is the argument of Thomas Paine back in the 1700s. He says, I can't create myself, so this is stupid for me to think that there's not a creator. Of course there's a creator. And he wasn't even a Bible believer. He was an infidel. He did not believe the Bible. He did not believe in Jesus. Didn't believe any of that stuff. But he knew there was a God, because it's the stupidest thing in the world to think something can create itself. So here, time, nothing exists, time pops into being. Or space, you know, like three dimensions, spatial dimensions. It's hard to even imagine when it doesn't exist. What would it be like if there was no space? It's not like everything shrinks and then the space is still there empty. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the space itself. It doesn't even exist. Think about it. How would it come to exist? Well, it can't. And matter. How does matter exist? Now, they do have sort of a way of figuring out how certain ranges of gravity and heat and all that stuff together can form the atoms into matter particles, and they say this happens in supernovas or who knows whatever, and that's how they, but I'm talking about not the actual matter that is existing at this moment, but the principles of physics that cause matter to exist. These depend upon very finely calibrated constants. They call them the six numbers. These numbers that if you move them just a little bit, matter cannot exist. Or, you know, just up or down, either way. And there's like six different ones. And the amount that you can move them is, you know, fraction of a percentage. And so, no, this had to have been created. And that's the only possible way that it could exist. It makes no sense to act like that it's a scientific theory that things just happened. Now, Hawking will just tell you that. Yeah, things just happened. Dawkins will tell you that, that it just happened. Most atheists even today will be bold enough to say, yeah, it just happened, even though that's the most absurd thing in the world, and it's certainly not scientific. The scientific evidence points to a creator. It always does. It never has pointed any other direction. There was never a time when scientists were so ignorant of the reality of things that they could have said, yeah, there must not be a God. That never has there been a time when scientific evidence pointed away from creation, even at the height of evolutionary fever, it never was there. So we know that there is a God. That is the scientific premise. There is a God, and you look at this book, read that book, and you'll see all of them made those claims. Back in the day, these were the smartest people of the day. People like Isaac Newton, way smarter than you and me. You know, what's the painter? Leonardo da Vinci. Or Blaise Pascal. All of those people, they're way smarter than us. And they're probably way smarter than Hawking and Dawkins and all these others. These were brilliant people that came up without any peers to guide them. They came up with some of the most amazing scientific insights. And all of them will tell you, no, oh, there is a God. Obviously, there's a God. More than that, I got another book. This one's called The Religious Origins of Modern Science, showing how modern science would never have developed in China or in India or in Indonesia or in Babylon, or in any of these other places. And it wouldn't even, it never did even develop in Greek Orthodoxy or Roman Catholicism. It originated in the Protestant thinking. Now, Protestant thinking, that doesn't mean none of them were Catholics. But you got to remember, before the Protestant Reformation, Catholics was everybody. Everybody was Catholic to some degree. Even the Reformers were Catholic. Martin Luther was a Catholic, but he was a Reformer. He wasn't a Catholic like we think of Catholics today. He wasn't a counter-Reformation type Catholic. What happened during the Reformation was Catholics that stayed with the Catholic Church tried to purge out all the free thinkers, all the people who, you know, wanted to think for themselves and didn't want to just accept what the hierarchy was telling them. And so they did what's called the Counter-Reformation, and they purged them out. And so Catholicism became more status quo, more dogmatic, more inquisitional. It became a much worse. Before the Counter-Reformation, Roman Catholicism was very hybrid. It had a lot of different thinking, a lot of different kinds of thinkers. But the Reformation-type thinking, starting with Wycliffe and probably even before Wycliffe. Some people have done studies to try to say that it existed before Wycliffe. I don't find it before Wycliffe, but Wycliffe is in the 1300s, so that's quite a ways before Luther. They started thinking by believing the Bible and believing the things that the Bible intimated and not believing the official religious dogma, the cosmos dogma that had been taught in the theological schools all those years that came from Greek and Egyptian mythology. The idea that the heavens are a dome that are held up on the corners by these huge angels, and that there's angels up above the dome that are cranking the gears and they're turning this thing so that, and you know, and then somebody, you know, opens a window and lets water come down, so that's how the rain formed. That was a cosmology that was ridiculous on its face. It comes from Egypt, it comes from ancient Greece, and not even the smart Egyptians believed that junk, and not even the smart Greeks believed that junk. All the smart ones knew a whole lot better than that, but somehow it became religious dogma that this is how these things happen. And they base their, sometimes the translations, the old translations, use that old terminology in order to, and you know, it might be poetic or whatever, but the idea is these Reformation believers says, no, we don't believe any of that. We're going to believe the two books of God. This is all the scientists come up with this, at least from Francis Bacon on, at least from John Ray and from these other early scientists. They believe the two books of God. The one book of God is the scripture. These are his revelation. This tells us about morality and about salvation. The second book of God is nature. That's the book of the created things. And if you look at that book, God will not lie. It will tell you the truth, and you can study that book, and it'll also help you arrive at understanding. And the whole idea of these early scientists was, we're going to think God's thoughts after him. I believe that wasn't Copernicus, it was just right after him. Kepler, maybe. Yes, it was Kepler. Kepler said, I'm thinking God's thoughts after him. And the idea is God put together this thing by a huge rational mind. He's very intelligent. He made it logical. Everything's logical. And this book here explains how it came about in this type of thinking, when everybody realizes God would not lie to us. God is not deceiving us. The things that we see are not mystical. They are true actions of God's original design. So what this did is caused people to say, okay, well, we can trust our eyes. We can trust our experiments. We can trust the things that we find out. We can go to the trouble to do an experiment, and whatever the result is, we can trust that. Whereas before that, they had the fears. They had the fears of the spirits deceiving and God being angry because you're doubting him or things like that. And that was a detriment to the idea of science. But what happened is with this, especially then with the Protestant Reformation, where where huge groups of people were free to discover, free to learn, and especially with the invention of the printing press, when if you discovered something, it could be next month, it could be all over the world. It'd be all over the world in the next month. The reason why the Pope couldn't kill Martin Luther the way he killed John Huss, a century before, the reason why was because 80% of the printing presses that had ever been invented or built were in Germany at that time. So when Martin Luther starts, his Reformation, the Pope would issue a bill. That bill that he would do, that he sent out, it would take 6 months to get everywhere, and only a few places would have it, and they'd put it in the square, and somebody might read it, but that's all. But Martin Luther would issue a reply, a rebuttal, and within 2 weeks, every place in Germany had a printed copy of what Luther's reply was. And they were getting their information about the Pope from the words that were found in the rebuttals written by Luther. So something happened in the Protestant Reformation that allowed information among the free thinkers, the believers, Protestants or the Reformed people. They had the power to just spread their information, and anything you discover, bang, it's in everybody's inbox. You just go out, and it got to the place where there were printers everywhere. There were printers on every block. This was like the internet back in those days. It was amazing. Everything went viral. You'd go out and for a couple pennies, you'd buy the latest pamphlet on whether it's political or whether it's religious or whatever, and you'd have it. It was better than television. This was the big thing in their day. So what happens is you get this scientific revolution where people start discovering truths. They discover why things burn. They just, like they didn't know why things burned before. Nobody had any idea what fire was. It looked very mysterious. What is fire? Can you imagine that? Like if you're just looking at fire, how are you going to tell what it is? You put your hand in, okay, it's hot, but that doesn't tell you what it is. What is fire? What is it? Why does it, it doesn't make any sense that, you get it hot and it starts burning and it becomes a flame and you pump air into it and it gets hotter and hotter and you can melt steel with it and all that. Nobody understood fire, but when they start doing some tests and somebody discovers there's some kind of an element in there, we can separate it out, and they learn all of these things, and it becomes a scientific revolution. They begin to discover things one on top of another, and nobody is shackled to believing a certain thing. Still, though, in the continent, in the southern continent, you had the Counter-Reformation, and they're fighting people like Copernicus. They're fighting because they don't want to lose their power. You've got the people in power, and they don't want these new upstarts coming in teaching something that might be demonic. They're fearful of that. And so, they threaten these people. They burn them at the stake. They don't like the new knowledge. That's why Galileo was threatened. He was like a 90-year-old man. I don't know how old he was. He was an old guy. He died 6 months after he did it. But the Inquisition got him and said, you recant. And all he had done was agreed with Copernicus. He had said, Copernicus is right. And he had these telescopes that he could prove it. He could prove what he was saying. And in order to save his life, he recanted, But, of course, he didn't really in his mind recant. He just recanted politically so that he could keep his life, which I don't blame him at all. And even though it's only 6 months, you might as well just go. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. All right, I got on a rabbit there. Let me see. There's several things that are interesting to me here. Not only the fact that the scientific nature of creation is found in the first day of creation, the very basic building blocks of creation are found there. What did I say? Time, space, matter, light, and law. These things had to have been created, and they had to have been created in the first day. That had to be the start. Nothing else could be done till that was done. The fact that it's called a firmament, which is a fantastic statement, the fact that it's called a firmament or an expansion. The fact that the dry land emerges from one ocean, which is called seas, one continent perhaps. That's interesting. They just now figured out that back in the day there was only one continent. That's only within the last 100 years that they figured that out. I'll tell you something else. There's several interesting things here in the first chapter of Genesis. I don't know if you guys have read the first chapter of Genesis. What stands out to you? For example, why does he name? Why does God? Well, no, even before that, before we get to that kind of a mystery, why are there days? Why is it divided up into days? Is it because God couldn't do it faster? I mean, obviously God could have done it all in one instant, right? He could have just said, let it be. And poof, we had all been here with memories fully formed. He could have done anything like that, right? But he divides it up into days.
He likes time. Seems to really like time. He's got time flowing through everything. Things take time. We live in time. He doesn't, but we do. He seems to like that for us.
Yeah, I don't like that explanation. That's not a good one. That's not a good one. I don't know.
I mean, if he did everything like you said, it would happen all at once.
I know that. I'm saying, but is it possible for us to come up with an understanding of why God divided up his creative acts into discrete days?
We really have time to choose between right and wrong.
Okay, I don't think it's about time. Obviously, he could have done it in a billion years, or he could have done it in an instant. We know that.
Day and night.
He made it all divided up into discrete points, things. And you got to try to figure out, well, why would he do that? He did it for a reason, obviously.
Well, for one, he's looking at it. Every step he's set
there. That's true. That's true.
So he's planning it out, or he's got the plan.
So you think he's developing his plan as he goes, maybe?
Well, you're talking about a vast, vast creation.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand the instant, but there's some things even we do that we could get it all done in one day, but yet you enjoy it, so you take a little longer because you're like, well, I might change this, or put the furniture over here, and put it back over there. So
he divided it up into segments because to enjoy it more.
Because he said, "He saw that it was good."
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he appreciated
that. Is
like
true.
An artist creates something.
That's true. It's like a masterpiece.
Yeah, the light was good.
Yeah, and you know, like you say, a masterpiece. Well, they don't paint painting. Some do, but some of the really good ones, how long did it take them to paint them, you know? Days, weeks?
Yep. Well, I don't know for sure.
No, I don't know.
I don't know, maybe for us to understand his plan.
I think you're close. And from my point of view, I think you're close. Because I see everything in creation is not just created for function. It's also created for teaching, for understanding something deeper. Nothing is simple. Nothing is simple. Like, for example, you've got ears on the side of your head. Why do you have ears? Why do we have ears on the side of our head? We have ears to hear, right? Sometimes you hear better. If you put your hand like this, you can hear a lot better. Well, that's what these ears. If you didn't have ears, you wouldn't hear even as good as you do hear right now. So it does help your hearing. But did you know it's also to regulate your temperature? Yeah, your ears release temperature. They release temperature so you can, it helps you regulate your temperature. That's why you have ear lobes. They say ear lobes are a vestigial organ, has no use. No, it's got real use. It has to do with surface area on your head that allows you to release temperature.
I wonder, they say that's the most accurate temperature. When you take the temperature, they say you do to your ears better than under your tongue.
All right, I'm going to go with I don't know on that. I don't know about that. My point wasn't that. My point was that there's more than one reason for an ear. God had more than one reason for that. And I bet you there's more than that. And I'll bet you look at everything you see, there's more than one reason for it. It's like it's a combination of reasons. So God might have had many reasons to do things in different days, you know, like it says he used the 7-day week and the day of rest, he sanctified it. And later on it says he did that for us so that we would know that you work 6 days and then you rest the day. You know, that's just, it's a way of setting up humanity with a workable schedule.
Just the design of it. I mean, just the fact that the earth is tilted 23 and a half degrees to give you 4 different seasons and you're a certain distance. I mean, yeah, this is all stuff that we figure out later in life.
Yeah, but he figured out that on that day.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you're talking about why did he do it, and it's to help us to teach us to understand him and his knowledge.
Okay, but the basic thing we're all coming to a conclusion here on is that he didn't do the days, he didn't do it in different days because he had no other choice or because he was developing a plan as he was going and he was, you know, evolving as he was going. That's not the reason. The reason is to teach us something or to set us up in life in the future. He had other many reasons for doing it this way, and we don't second guess his reasons for doing it in this. We just try to figure them out, obviously. But he did it on purpose. He said, okay, I could create this almost any old way I want. In fact, I could tell the angels, I could create an angel to create this. That's what the Jehovah's Witnesses say. God created an angel, Jesus, to create the earth. So, you know, to create the world. Well, that's, he could have done that if he had wanted to. The Bible doesn't say that he did that, but he could have. But he did it this way for more than necessity. It was for us to learn something about it. It's for us to see the progression of his creative enterprise. He creates the simplest first, and he goes and gets bigger and bigger. And what was the last thing he created? Nope, woman. How did you miss that? The last thing he created was woman. So what is the epitome? What's the height of the creation? Men, it's women. Women are the crown of the creation, according to the concept that he starts with the simple, which is like, okay, I'm going to create time. That's pretty simple. It's going to go forward. Never goes backward. Always go forward. It's about as simple a dimension as you can have. Then I'm going to create space, 3 dimensions, right? Then I'm going to create matter, which is pretty convoluted. If you ever study chemistry or subatomic particles or whatever, that's pretty convoluted. And then he gets into electromagnetism, which is, it's really difficult to comprehend how these waves propagate through emptiness. It's not even, who knows how that works? This is very complicated that physicists don't understand to this day. In fact, I've got a book on the property of light. It's just light. It's all about light. And it's trying to explain these huge mysteries that they have about light. They do not understand. Well, I can't even understand the book. The book is very, and he says this is for a layman. This is to help laymen understand the difficulties us physicists have. And I'm not just an ordinary layman. I've read a lot of books, but this book confuses me. I have to go back and read the same chapter several times to try to figure out what it is that I don't understand. It's amazing. Light is extremely complex, and he creates these things in order. And then he creates an earth. You know, he creates seas. And then he creates first he creates firmament and waters above it and waters below it. And then he creates the dry land. And then he says, let the earth bring, let the waters bring forth. And then he says, okay, I'm going to put these planets in place and the stars and the sun and the moon. They're going to be for seasons. And he's creating something complex, a complex ecosystem for living things, and then he creates the living things, and then on land, and he gets down to the end, and he creates man, and then he creates woman, and then he rests and says, all right, the work is finished, which means he's not creating now, which is something the Bible says very clearly, that the work of creation finished after day 6. It says it several times. The works were finished from the foundation of the world. God is not at this moment creating new species. That's a very strong argument against theistic evolution. The idea that God has been continually creating. The Bible specifically states that he rested and stopped his creative work. So from the point that it was originally created, it has only gone downhill from there. But all of this stuff was done, creation was done for that reason. I think part of it is he wanted to be poetic. I think God is a poet. I mean, seriously, the stuff he puts together, if you really study it out, you gotta think, wow, how did he come up with that? I was just looking at some Curiosity Stream thing, you know, whatever they were diving in the Mediterranean, and they found these very rare squids, and they actually photographed them. It's like the only time ever been photographed. They photographed them mating, having sex, however they do that, but it's, you know, sort of a strange thing. But they photographed them doing that, and I was thinking, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. This division of the sexes and all of this stuff is told us in the Bible that this is a poetic representation of something greater, something bigger. These things have meaning. God has filled everything in this earth, in this universe, with meaning, with some greater purpose. Someone says, well, it's about beauty, but there's an awful lot of stuff that's not beautiful. Some stuff is hideous. They've done that. Have y'all seen those pictures of the deep, 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 deep sea creatures? The closer you get to hell, man, the uglier you are. Those things are hideous. They look like those alien creatures out there in the imagination. So it's not all beauty. And in fact, have you ever seen a hyena? You know, those things are not beautiful. So, or a roach. Come on. You guys like roaches? Yeah, I'm telling you. Of course, I did see some very beautiful roaches one time. Yeah. We were in the Huasteca, and I was on a hammock, and in the night, you could see these little things crawling up on the thatched roof, and I've had my hammock hanging in there because I don't want to be on the ground. So I'm laying on the hammock, and plop, lands on me, and it's a roach. But it's a green roach. And I don't mean it's a green roach like the Cuban green roaches. It's like a fluorescent green. It's like those beetles that have that like very brilliant type of a green. That's the kind of green it is. And they were a little fatter than our normal roaches. So I got to tell you, they were quite impressive, these little roaches. I've never seen them described. I've looked them, tried to look them up, find out what they are. I've never seen them described at all. In fact, it almost makes me doubt my memory that I remember that, because I can't find them anywhere. Nobody knows anything about these things. But I know that I saw them, and I was very impressed by them. And someday I want to drive back to that same town called Soledad and find those roaches so I can take some pictures of them. And back in those days, we didn't have cameras that easily, you know, not in your cell phone. Anyway, I think he divides it up into days, because there's some symbolism there. Some people, in fact, throughout history, people have believed that those days represented thousand-year periods. And to this day, some people believe represents thousand-year period. If you add up all the years that you find in Genesis, we're in the range of about 6,000 years now. And so the idea is, at the end of the 6,000 years, there's going to be the seventh, which is the day of rest, which is the millennial reign. Now, I don't subscribe to that. I used to, but I don't really anymore. I have no idea whether that's legitimate. I don't find it anywhere in the Bible. It has been believed. I think Josephus, I think some of the people before Christ have mentioned that. I definitely know a lot of people after Christ have mentioned their belief in that. I think it was Eusebius that believed that 200 or 300 years after Christ. It's an interesting theory, but the idea is that what God wrote in the Bible is more than just information. It's a poem. It is a huge allegory of other things. And I can't help but believe that there's some truth to that, because just the sexual division we know is an allegory. The Bible says it is. I'm speaking about Christ and the church. It's a great mystery, right? Notice a few other things. Like, for example, in verse 11, this verse has not been used by the theistic evolutionists much. I have not read it in any of their literature or what have you, but I've had it rejected by people who disagree with certain translations in Spanish. They disagreed with this because it taught evolution, and I've never heard the argument in English. It's interesting. But if you look at verse 11, it says, God said, let the earth bring forth grass. And what does that sound like to you? Doesn't that sound to you like God says, earth, bring forth grass? Like spontaneous generation, just grass, come on up.
Yeah.
It sounds a little bit like evolution. Like God says, let's put this evolution into motion by me giving the command, and the earth is just going to sprout some grass and all kinds of grass. And it's not like he formed it in that verse. It doesn't make it clear that he formed it with his hands or anything, right? And if you look also at verse 20, and God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature. Once again, he uses that crazy phrase, let the waters bring it forth. He didn't say, I'm going to make these creatures and put them in the water. He says, let the water do it, as if there's some power in the water to bring forth big whales and stuff. Now, you see, in my mind, theistic evolutionists, people who think that this is representative of millions of years and that these things were created over the millions of years and that they just formed by natural processes, that's a verse that seems to agree with the evolutionary concept. In my mind, now you guys might consider me a heretic and you say, yeah, I'm not listening to you anymore. In my mind, I don't fear that, because if that's a possibility, I'm open to it. I'm listening. Show me that that's true. I don't believe we can successfully disagree or logically disagree with the theory of evolution unless we actually are open to it being proven true. If we are dogmatic and saying it can't be true, then we can't look at real evidence and come to a real conclusion. It's sort of like the George Floyd, Derek Chauvin trial. He was found guilty. He may have been guilty. He may have deserved everything that happened to him, but you can't say it was a fair trial if they're intimidating the jury, and the jury knows that they will be running for their life for the rest of their life if they find him innocent. So it might be exactly what needed to happen, what have you, but you can't call it a fair trial because they didn't sequester the jury, and I don't even think he could have possibly gotten a fair trial because that information is everywhere and people are so angry about it that they will not allow him to be considered or to be found not guilty. So the same way, if we act in such a way so antagonistic to the theory of evolution that we don't allow it to present its evidence and us come to a decision based on the evidence, and what this allows us to do is to look at evolution with an open mind. The concept of evolution, not natural evolution as in happened without God. We know that that's ridiculous. We're not going to lose our minds and say that this all happened without any intelligence behind it. We know better than that. But how about if God decided I'm going to do it by putting in a principle in play that things will spontaneously generate and improve over time? If God wanted to do that, he could do it. And there you go. You got some verses that'll defend you if you want to say that. I don't think that holds water. But we don't have to have a dogmatic Bible-based disbelief in it without any kind of willingness to listen to the evidence. He says, God created great whales and every living creature that moveth, which the waters brought forth abundantly, 21, after their kind. Why he phrased it that way, I do not know. But I know it is significant. He said, the waters brought them forth. Somehow the water had something to do with it. Or that's just a poetic way of saying, here they came. They started appearing in the water.
In the same verse, it says, when God created, and which the water brought forth. So it's like he's saying it's the same thing.
Yeah, that's how he created it. The waters brought it forth. I will point out, though, that that doesn't hold water. And I was hoping someday somebody in a debate with me would use that verse and then I would have the answer, but they never have done that for me. So anyway, if you'll look at chapter 2 and verse 4, this is one of the mysteries of the creation narrative, and that is there's two almost contradictory. They're really not contradictory, but they're a little different, two different narratives. They say that these were two different myths that somebody tried to put together. But if you look at chapter 2 and verse 4, these are the generations of the heavens and of the earth when they were created in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. Every plant of the field before it was in the earth, and every herb of the field before it grew. He created them before he planted them. You read that? Y'all see it? The earth did not bring them forth by itself. The earth brought them forth after he planted them. That's what he's saying. So obviously, yes, if you plant seed in the earth's going to bring them forth. That's the meaning of that. And when he created the whales, he created them and put them in the water, and they were fruitful and multiplied, and the water brought them forth. That's the way I understand it. Because there it says very clearly, every plant of the field before it was in the earth was created. All right. How about this? One thing I'm pointing out to you is things that are counterintuitive to our thinking naturally. For example, fowl came from the waters. You know what it says? It says, let this here, earth, where are the waters? Okay, the universe, let there be lights. So, okay, there it is, verse 20. God said, let the waters bring forth abundantly the moving creature that hath life, and fowl that may fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. Verse 20. So, birds came from the water. Does that make any sense? I mean, it's not intuitive. It's not like if I was making up a creation myth that I would have said, you know, I think I'm going to make it so that birds come out of the water. I don't think any human being would naturally gravitate toward that explanation. They would think of fish and whales coming out of the water. There might be other things they could think of coming out of the water. Maybe even plants. Maybe even trees coming out of the water. But they wouldn't think of birds coming out of the water.
But is that because that's what we've experienced? That's what we've seen. He was working from a blank slate. I mean, those are things that we think because we think fishes are in the water, birds are in the air.
So why wouldn't, if somebody, I'm just pointing out how if somebody was inventing this story, if this is a creation myth made up by somebody, how are they going to come up with the idea that birds came out of the water? They would say birds came out of the air. He says, I'm going to let the air or the open firmament of heaven bring forth fowl. They would have come up with something like that. This is information that God gave us how he created that is not intuitive. It doesn't come from human thinking. It's not logical. It is counterintuitive. It shocks you when you hear it. How is that possible? How is it possible that birds are expected to come out of the water? I'll tell you another one. We have the idea that whales are mammals. They're not fish. Whales are mammals, right? And so are dolphins and all that. And we know that because they bear young and they have fur and they nurse their young with milk. And so these are mammals. Even though they look like fish, but they're mammals. But the concept that we have is that the mammals used to be bears and they did a lot of swimming. And so then their paws got bigger and bigger until they turned into whales. You know, that's the idea that people have. But in the Bible, it says that God created the whales before he created land mammals. A whole day before. Because it was on the fifth day he created the whales. And it was on the sixth day, in the early part of it, that he created the beasts that walk around on the earth. So God threw in some monkey wrenches into the works and said, okay, this might confuse you a little bit, but he's given you information. This is how I did it. And I believe he did it for poetic reasons and teaching reasons and masterpiece craftsman type reasons, not so much because it was easier for him to bring birds out of the water than out of the air. I believe he created these things in his mind, and he has a code. He has a code that connects to nature in some way so that he spits out this code. He speaks it, and it causes it to form. That's how he speaks the word and the laws of physics happen. Those are some interesting things. How about the fact that the third day he creates the plants and plants them, and the fourth day he creates the sun and the moon and the stars? Doesn't that put a real difficulty? First of all, it's counterintuitive. It's counterintuitive that the sun was made after he made plants and put them on the earth. That's counterintuitive. It's also very much a problem for people who believe in theistic evolution, where God over billions of years is creating all this stuff. And so however many billions of years each day represents, or however many millions of years each day represents, there's a whole lot of million years that we had to have plants on the earth without any sun. Right? That's one of the indications that he's not talking about extended periods of time, the day-age theory, that the days represent ages, eons of time. He had the sun created on the fourth day, and the plants were created on the third day. That's counterintuitive, and it's instructive. It gives you an idea that God did this in a creative fashion, not in a evolutionary process fashion. That's an indication. I wouldn't say dogmatically you can't ever consider the concept of a process. That maybe there is a process. I don't know. Notice that he says he formed man out of the dust of the ground. Does he say it? He says, and God said, So God created man. Where is it? There it is, verse 7, chapter 2, verse 7. And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground. Have you ever heard him saying, of dust thou art, and to dust thou shalt return? Now, that's not in the Bible. That's just a poetic thing that priests say when somebody dies. To dust you shall return. Although there's some places in the Bible that does say something similar to that. But that phrase itself is not in the Bible, not talking about people dying. But he says, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, that sort of thing. That's not in the Bible. Anyway, here he says, God formed man of the dust of the ground. So what most people think of is that God spit on the ground, got a bunch of ball of clay, and he sculpted it like Michelangelo. He stretches it out there, and there he is, and it's all formed on the exterior. It looks just like a man, and then he breathes into it, and poof, it becomes a man. But that's not what it says. Right? It says, God formed man out of the dust of the ground. Dust is not mud. What is dust?
Very small.
Microscopic particles. Can't see it individually with your naked eye. It's you see clouds of it and you see the residue of it, but it's just too small to see. So what did he do when he made man? He made man out of very, very small particles. Elements and DNA. Think about it. This is written into our text as early as, you know, Moses, at least. And it's explaining to you that we are created by microscopic intelligence. We have a microscopic code inside of us that creates us. So God, when he formed man, how did he do it? He, in his code that he can speak the word, he speaks the word in this code, and it makes all these proteins form and fold. If you've ever studied biology, microbiology, where it tells you how these elements, these amino acids form together, these proteins, and these proteins automatically fold a certain way, it's all a logical puzzle, and when they're put together in a certain order, these things fold up into three-dimensional forms, like little machines, and some of them will fit exactly together. This is a tremendously complex thing that the DNA does, forms these proteins that mix and hook together, and they just keep forming them, and they can do it billions of times, over their lifespan. It just keeps forming these things out of these acids, these little amino acids. All of them, what are they? All of them left-handed, no right-handed ones. It's one of the strange anomalies of of naturalistic evolution that they can't figure out why didn't some right-handed ones happen? No, they're all left-handed ones. They're all turned a certain way. And they come together and they form multicellular organisms. And they form cells. It is a tremendous mystery. And it's all by an intelligent language written into DNA code.
But your body has to have the elements of the earth, like iron and potassium and sodium.
Yeah, but those are elements. What we're talking about is amino acids, and amino acids are extremely complex. I mean, they aren't complex in the sense of how many elements they form. I believe it's just carbon and hydrogen and carbohydrates, right? I think that's all it is, carbon and hydrogen. But these elements are strange. If you study particle physics, you study these deeper fields of this stuff, and you find out that these elements and how they react, how they relate, it's a mystery. Why in the world does carbon have the properties that it has, and why does like the combination of hydrogen and oxygen have the properties it has? It's a strange mix because, for example, if hydrogen and oxygen are separate or they form into a different type of a bond, well, they have the properties just like every other molecule on Earth. The colder it gets, the more it shrinks. But in water, H2O, that's that one special molecule. It's the one, the only one, that when it gets colder and colder and colder and it turns into an ice, it expands. It has a significant expansion. I don't know if it's 6 or 8% or something like that. It expands significantly. And what that does is it causes ice to float so that when ice melts, the ice floats to the top. If the ice didn't float, it would sink to the bottom and stay there, frozen forever, until all the oceans would be solid frozen all the way through and nothing could live in them. And I don't know if you noticed it, but it ice wouldn't be slippery either. It'd be like every other frozen thing. You'd step on it and it wouldn't slide. But if you step on ice, it becomes slippery because the pressure that you put on it causes just a little bit to melt because it reduces its size and it causes it to become slippery. That's why ice is slippery, because of the expansion effect. This is a mystery. It's like, how could you come up with this? Every so often you need to talk to God and say, God, how did you come up with this? This is amazing. This blows me away. So the idea is God put these things together and he makes man out of the dust of the ground. The complexity of what's happened here is belied by the simplicity of the declaration. But the truth is there. Just like when David says in Psalm 139, have you noticed that? He says, Thou madest me curiously in the lower parts of the earth. Interesting statement. Curiously means intricately, very, very sophisticatedly. That's what that means, curiously. Like when he says the curious arts, and they had the curious embroidery on the tabernacle, it's talking about very intricate, sophisticated embroidery that was put into the tabernacle. Well, right there in Psalm 139, he says, you made me curiously, that means very sophisticatedly, in the lower parts of the earth. Not talking about the foundations of the mountains, but talking about the microscopic part of creation. The lower parts of the earth is the microscopic. And that's how when I was a microscopic little speck, I was sophisticated, made by you. That's what David was expressing 1,000 years before Christ, 3,000 years ago. And this is stuff scientists have just now begun to figure out how truly true it is, how amazing it is. So anyway, God made man out of the dust of the earth. Notice that he planted a garden and it grew. Look where we at. Genesis chapter 2, verse 8. And the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground made the Lord God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and a river went out, etc. It says he planted a garden, and it grew. And then he says he placed the man in the garden. And then he brought all the animals to the man for the man to name them. And then he caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he made the woman. And in Genesis chapter 1, it says he made them male and female in the sixth day. In fact, in the sixth afternoon, because he made all the mammals in the morning. So what does that tell us about this day? Something's funny about this sixth day. I don't know. That seems a little strange to me. He made a male and female in the sixth day, but then he gives us the detail of how he made them. He made the man out of the dust of the ground. He planted a garden, and it grew. He has trees all over this garden. Then he makes this man, and he puts him into the garden, and then he brings the beasts of the field, which had grown. These were grown-up beasts that he brings to Adam, and Adam names them, and then he creates the woman. Y'all see the problem? There's like something like overlapping here. There's no way that this garden grew in 30 minutes. I mean, I guess there's ways. I guess God could. I saw Star Trek, you know, that one Star Trek movie where they had that, one pod they sent out on this desert planet, and in 6 hours it became a Garden of Eden. You know, it became a lush planet. So, you know, who knows? If you can imagine it, I guess it's possible. But it seems to me like this story is more complex than we read it at first. So this day of creation, does it mean that the creation on that day was completely formed full? Or is that just the day he sets it all in motion? Is the day of his creation how he gets it all in his mind and then he makes it happen over billions of years or millions of years? Or is this an actual day of creation and forming things and causing them to happen? Because it says on the fifth day, he says, made great whales. He made great whales and the waters brought them forth abundantly on that day. I do not know. I'm not going to tell you dogmatically that, you know, that the day age theory is right because I see evidence against it. And I can't say dogmatically that this was all formed complete. I mean, Adam had the Garden of Eden and the Tree of Life and everything done in the first day. He did it all in one afternoon. I don't know. I don't know how to explain that. I just know that we need to have our minds clear on what really the Bible actually is saying. And not assume that because he says he formed him out of the dust of the ground, that he must have sculpted a human being out of clay and then breathed into it and it magically became a human. Obviously, a human is much, much more complex than clay. And when he says he formed it out of the dust, he was forming it out of microscopic code in amino acids and tremendous sophistication in this creation. Then he creates the woman, and she is so sophisticated. Nobody understands them yet. Anyway. All right, I'm going to point out a few things here. We're getting near to where we need to end. Notice that creation, there's a lot of arguments about creation that just absolutely demolishes the normal, unbelieving, atheistical idea that we're getting taught in our schools, that the Bible is a bunch of hokey or whatever. Consider the concept of design. Design means there's a mind behind it. There's a craftsman. There's somebody who thought it up, who thought it out, and put it together and made it work. That's design. There's something called law. It's something where there's somebody with authority that gives a command, and this command is obeyed. That's the law. We call it the law of gravity. It's obeyed. Every single time it's obeyed. Even light obeys the law of gravity. Everything obeys the law of gravity. Why? That's why we call it a law. But just the concept of a law implies a mind and a power that enforces that law, that makes that happen. There's got to be a force behind the law. All right? There's the concept of language, and that is you have a source and you have a target. Language is not just a one person thing. No one person has a language. Language is for communication so that one person speaks and the other person understands, right? And we have a language, it's like a computer language, it's a digital language in our DNA, and I believe we'll find more types of languages the more we search, even in the depths of creation, but our DNA is a language, meaning it has a source, somebody wrote that language, and it has a recipient, a target, that there's something that understands that language, something in creation, and it obeys what the language says. And it gives us a much better understanding of what it means when it says God said, He spoke the worlds into existence. When He said, let there be light, He's putting out a code of language and saying, this is what's going to happen. Just like when I write a computer program, I've written a lot of computer programs. One time I wrote a computer program because we had an argument over which Monopoly square is the most landed on, and we saw somebody say that the Monopoly square that was most landed on was Illinois, and I played Monopoly since I was knee-high to an anthill, and we played it day in and day out, hours on end. We were experts. We had the rules memorized. We knew Monopoly, and I was dead sure Illinois was not the most landed on piece. So I wrote a program to play Monopoly. 20 million iterations, you know, just however, I wrote all the chance cards, I wrote everything in, I put in the random generators with the dice and had the pieces play and it just went around. It played it and played it and played it billions and billions of times around. And it's St. James Place, people. not by a big amount, but.
Yes.
Not the cheapest, nope. It's halfway. But St. James and Tennessee are very, very close. Illinois is way down there. But the point that I'm making is, I wrote that program, I wanted it to do a certain thing, and it did that certain thing. I wrote the program with words. With words. I typed in words, and the computer understood my words and did what I told it to do. Now that's the point that I'm making. God spoke all this stuff. It's all a matter of intelligence. He says He founded the world by His wisdom and by His understanding. It's His wisdom and His understanding that made the world, not His power or His craftsmanship or His skill with His hands. He didn't form humans with His hands like a sculpture. He formed them with His mind and spoke them into the dust, and the dust created the body. Now, it becomes sort of a moot point, not like a really important point, whether this took a day to happen or whether it took a million years to happen. This happened by creation. In other words, we could say that His 6 days of creation are Him writing the programs. He writes the program for this on the first day. Then He writes the program for this on the second day. He writes all these things out, and then He sets them into motion, and they happen over billions of years. If they want to argue that, they can argue that. In my mind, that doesn't detract at all from the fact that we have a creation here that is just as significant as if He had done it with His fingers and His hands and stretching out the heavens with His fingers and stretching them out. The idea that He writes it that way doesn't mean we have to take it in some sort of a literal sense that God with His hands stretched out the heaven. He stretched it out, obviously, and that's a poetic way of saying it. He stretched it out with His hands, but obviously He stretched it out with the power of His word. He created the worlds with the power of His word. All right, that's language. We have history, records, testimony of creation. We know we have writings from way back, including the books of Genesis and Job and things like that. But there are other writings besides these that talk about this type of creation earlier on. And they're all in unity. This is a single God created this stuff. So it's not just we're not just making this stuff up because we're logical. We also have records of this happening from way back, including things like the flood, which is found in Genesis, but it's also found in almost every major society that's ever lived, that's ever existed on earth. It was found in the Incas. It was found in the Aztecs. It was found in the Hindus. It was found in China. It's found in Africa. It's found in the Indonesian islands. It's found in the Aborigines in Australia. The concept of a flood that killed everybody on earth. Found in the Babylonian Gilgamesh epic. It's found everywhere. So we have historical records that confirm the creation account. We have logic. The idea of a mind, there has to be a mind behind the design. And the logic is not bound by the brain. You guys know the difference between mind and brain. I mean, we confuse them sometimes because we think our mind is in our brain. But even the scientists now call it the emergence of mind from the brain. And when they talk about artificial intelligence, they're trying to get a mind to happen in a computer. They're trying to get a computer sophisticated enough that a mind will emerge. So it would be automatic, it would be what they call artificial intelligence. They're not even close. They don't even know what they're waiting for, what's supposed to come next. They just keep trying to get more and more sophisticated, give a bunch of, you know, what they're doing is making very sophisticated programs that have already programmed into them what they do when they encounter certain things. And that's not what our mind is. Our mind is a sense of identity. Our mind is a personality. Our mind is more than a brain. And the existence of mind cannot be explained by the existence of matter. Not even brain matter. And we have the concept of anthropism. Anthropism. That's not right. It's the anthropic principle. Now this was, the anthropic principle is the fact that things are made for man. Everything is made to fit man's needs. Anthropic principle. Now this, the unbelieving scientists came up with this at first, and their concept was this. If it hadn't been this way, we would not have existed. So it had to be this way because we do exist, right? That's the anthropic principle. That's the unbelieving way of thinking about it. But think about it just the opposite way. Look at it from the other side of it and think about how everything is fit for us. I've used this example a few times. Look at the sun that God says, I made the lesser light, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the... So obviously God says, I made these two lights for man. That's what God says. That's the anthropic principle. I made these for man so they could see at night. They could see in the day. That sort of thing, right? And then we look at them and they are at exactly the same size in the sky. Measure them. Get out there and measure them. They're the same apparent size in the sky. Now, they're completely different sizes of balls out in space. One's huge and one's real small, relatively. Bigger than your car, but it's small compared to the sun. But when you look at them, they're the same size in the sky. What are the chances of having a moon and a sun in any planet out there that are the same size in the sky? You can do the calculations. It's astronomically low. It's astronomically low. It's not likely that you'll have a random satellite going around that the appearance is going to come out exactly the same in the sky. So much so that they cross paths and they have eclipses. And if you'll see an eclipse, I don't know if you've ever seen an actual total eclipse where the moon covers the sun, it just covers it. It is a strange thing. I've seen two eclipses. One we saw in San Luis Potosí in 82. And we were out, maybe it was 83, I don't remember, but it was one of those years I was in San Luis Potosí, and we knew it was going to have an eclipse during the day, a solar eclipse, so we expected it to get dark. But it was cloudy, so we couldn't see the sun or anything. And it got a little darker. They called a total annular eclipse, meaning the moon was slightly smaller than the sun so that the sun still could shine around it. So it didn't get real, because they're on ellipses. They're not in exact circles. So the moon is sometimes a little closer to the earth, makes it bigger. Sometimes it's a little farther from the earth, makes it a little smaller. And so at that time it was what they call the apogee or whatever. It's a little farther away from the earth. So it was smaller than the sun. Barely, but it was. So you had an annular, a ring around it that was the sun. And it didn't hardly get dark. I was outside welding on something and we were working and it was sort of cloudy and it got a little bit darker, but not much. And so when we found out we were going to have another eclipse, this was back in the 90s in Aguascalientes, maybe 91 or something. I said, well, kids, let's go out there because this time it wasn't going to be cloud covered. It's going to be nice. And we were in the path of the total eclipse. So I said, let's get our, I got us a bunch of, were you there? You guys were there, weren't you? We got us a bunch of negative, we had a print shop and so we had a whole bunch of negatives, material, and I cut them up and made them little glasses so they could look at the sun or whatever. And so we're out there, you know, waiting for it to happen. And this time it was a total. It wasn't annular. It was a total eclipse. And you just saw it. And it was light, 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 and then, whoop. I don't know, man, it lasted maybe 30 seconds or something like that, or 20 seconds, but it was just dark. It went dark. All the street lights came on. It was like nighttime. You could see the stars. It was incredible. It just blew me away. Well, see, that's the anthropic principle. God made, that design was made for man. And that's just one out of millions of different aspects of our creation that are made for man. They talk about the electromagnetic spectrum. Electromagnetism goes from a frequency that's unbelievably long and then a frequency that's unbelievably small that there's a certain limit that they can't get to any smaller than that. It's the Planck limit or whatever they call it. And then there's the length that becomes bigger than the universe or whatever. But you get that and you measure it, the difference between these frequencies, and you measure it, in units of millions or whatever it is. And a very small section of that frequency range is what we call visible light. And that small section of visible light is what can pass through our atmosphere of nitrogen and oxygen. It doesn't pass through the atmosphere of methane and other gases. But it passes through our. It's this very small spectrum of visible light. And there's no real difference between the visible light and the ultraviolet on one side and the infrared on the other side. There's no actual difference, just a slight difference in the frequency. Just a little bit difference in the wavelength of those lights. But one you can see and one you can't. But if you get on those other ones, those are the ones that are not, you're not capable of making a picture of or forming an image by them because they don't pass through the right kind of medium and because they become either too big or too small to make it work. You'd have to read the books on it to just understand why. But the point is that it's a minute section that is actually visible, and it's the section that is visible that is sent out by our sun and that our eyes can perceive. Now, an unbelieving atheist would say, well, it had to be that way because we're here. And the reason why we can see that is because that's what was available. And that's how we formed or what have you. But just apply a little bit of faith and recognize that this was an anthropic principle. God says, I'm making this for you, mankind. And men are going to be able to see this much. And women are going to be able to see this much. They say that's true. They say that women see more than men.
But then it also protects us because some light, like the ultraviolet light, that's dangerous to your eyes, to your skin.
Man, you are so right. The anthropic principle is one of the huge principles here that we're talking about because things like the ozone layer, things like the magnetism of the earth, the all the what do they call those other rays that don't come into the atmosphere because of the electromagnetic magnetism of the earth. It forces everything to go off to the outside of the earth, of the atmosphere. All of that stuff. Just the idea of the atmosphere being 79% nitrogen and 21% oxygen or whatever the actual numbers are. Just that, in order to make fires possible, but that you're not always spontaneously combusting, you know. You don't light on fire by accident, you know. These things are absolutely necessary for life. If you look at all the things that are necessary for our lives to be here, that's called the anthropic principle, and it had to have happened. And the unbelievers will say, well, of course, it had to have happened that way, because if it hadn't happened that way, we wouldn't exist to observe it or to comment on it, which is true. But just use your brain a little bit and realize this was designed by somebody who wanted us to have certain abilities. Just the idea of eclipses allow us to determine time way back. I'm studying a book called The Mysterious Numbers of the Kings, because it's trying to explain how these kingly lists fit together, and does a masterful job on almost all the length of the kings. I think he messed up on the last Hoshea and Hezekiah and all them. But the first 300 years of the kings, he shows how all this thing fits in. And then he gets these lists of eclipses that have been recorded when they happen, and it puts together all of our calendars so that we can tell exactly what date. Because of these eclipses, we can calculate them back astronomically and get an exact date when this happened on this place at this time. And they put it together and make an entire history of the world all the way back to 2500 BC.
I wondered about that, because when you track back in time like that, what happens when God moved the sun back? I mean, don't you lose some time somewhere?
Yeah, that happened quite a ways ago, so I don't know how much it would interfere with us, because that was in Joshua's time, right?
But I mean, it just amazes me.
Or Hezekiah. Was it Hezekiah? Ahaz. There's a dial of Ahaz on Hezekiah's day.
I know we're talking 20 degrees or something. It's really not relevant in time, but
I don't know. I've heard Bible scholars talk about that and say, we found evidence of whatever, but I don't trust them.
Yeah.
I just don't trust their scholarship. I'm looking for people who really know their business, and I'm not sure that they do.
Yeah, and see, that's the other thing. I mean, you get into the time spectrum, and then they talk about weather and stuff today. Well, you only have so many recordings in parts of the world that talk about weather, severe weather back then. But I don't know how they could say that all this climate change is going on.
Oh, I don't know about climate change. I see evidences of it, but I don't know what that all means. I'm not afraid of climate change. I would like a few more hurricanes.
Anyway,
we're getting to the end of this today. There was one more point. I had to finish that one, or else I won't get it done. I said anthropism also, and the evolution of science. Science itself comes from belief in the Bible. Science itself, that's what this book is about. Oh, and this is another book I brought just to mention. It's also by Henry Morris, The Bible and Modern Science. This is the book that started the modern creationist movement. This is the book. It's a very simple little book. I got it at a used bookstore for $1.98. You can find them. They're everywhere. The Bible and Modern Science by Henry Morris, written in 1951. It's what started the modern creationist movement. After he got famous with this one, he wrote one with John Whitcomb called The Genesis Flood, explaining how flood geology explains the most of the features of Earth. Doesn't explain radiometric dating and stuff like that, but it explains a lot of stuff. And it's a very important book in that range. Anyway, I just brought these just to mention them. I would have brought that one also, but I must have loaned it. I don't have it. Can't find it. Somebody have a comment?
This is really good, but I just to go back real quickly. Time, you thought time, you separated things into time, day, night, and then I lost somehow in all this. I lost what you thought. Why he did that?
I think he did it for multiple reasons, and it's allegorical. It's for teaching purposes. It's for he had some other reason for doing it, that this is a reasonable thing. He wasn't forced to do it that way. Yeah. It wasn't an evolution of his thinking, because this is God. It was all a plan, and the reason why he separates it out into discrete days and stuff is for teaching purposes, or for poetic or craftsman purposes, or whatever his masterpiece purposes are. But it's not nothing. It's not because he wasn't in a rush, and he wasn't hurried, and he wasn't slowing everything down because he had to or anything. It's just because it's a teaching thing. And if it's a teaching thing, then we shouldn't get too dogmatic. I don't believe we should be so dogmatic as to say it was created in 6 24-hour periods when the sun wasn't created until the fourth day. So let's not go overboard and call people like Hugh Ross and other long earth, old earth creationists, call them heretics or anything. We just don't know. It's not really clear. They've got some verses on their side, and we got a lot of verses that say the other side. We just have to be more open-minded and let the evidence rule us a little bit. I don't think we have anything to fear from atheistic science.
No, we don't.
I do not believe anybody here should be in any way intimidated by atheistic scientists. They have stepped off the rational wagon. They are not thinking straight. And I've had these semi-short debates with people where they say, oh, no, I'm an atheist. I don't believe that junk. I don't believe whatever. And I had this one guy. He gave me a newspaper article about creation, and he talked about the Big Bang at the start. He said, I want you to read this article, because he knew I believed the Bible, and he was atheistical. And so he said, read this article and give me your comments. And so I read like the first five or six I read the whole article, but the first five or six paragraphs, I just started marking. I had a pencil or whatever, and I marked on it. It said the beginning was a Big Bang, and I circled that thing and I wrote down supernatural, because the Big Bang has to be supernatural. It has to be supernatural. It can't be anything less than supernatural. He picked up the newspaper after I'd done that. He looked at it, the first word, and he says, you know, you're right. It has to be supernatural. It's like he had never thought it before. It never crossed his mind that a Big Bang, starting all of the energy and density and everything that's in the universe, was in a singularity, a little small dot. And then it exploded. I thought when it all gets together, it becomes supergravity, a black hole, and it can't go anywhere. Not even light can escape that kind of a density. But no, it explodes, it expands, and it's increasing its expansion. That's the Big Bang. And you're saying that's not supernatural? We have nothing to be intimidated by the atheistical scientists. If there's evidence of something, let's accept it. Let's be reasonable and see the Bible for what it is. It's one of the two books of nature. It's one of the two books of God. The book of God's word, which is his moral teaching and his revelations, and the book of nature, which he's not going to lie to us. Too many Christians have thought, well, the fossils, they were put there by the devil to deceive us. No, the book of nature is not going to lie to us. It's going to give us true information, and we're going to figure things out by what God has showed us. Anyway, we've got
the revelation that God's not playing some game, that he's not a liar, that he's not wasting time making lies out in nature to fool people. You think that belief, that revelation came during the Protestant?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and even though Protestants have also had that weakness.
Because that gave you finally, you had a rock to stand on. You say, well, God's not wasting his time putting things out there that are lies.
That you can trust the evidence that you get from creation. Yes, that did come through the Protestant Reformation. All right, let's pray and dismiss ourselves. Lord, thank you for an opportunity to talk about your word. And we love you, Lord. We love your creation. We love your book. And we want to know the truth, and we want to be champions for truth. We want to be able to show the truth to other people, Lord. Make us wise. I ask you to bless us in our plans and our fellowship in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.